Welcome to Walk the Talk with me, Dave Thomas. Thank you for downloading this edition of the programme. I do hope you enjoy it. 1 year ago, I broadcast my very first podcast with the then Deputy Chief Constable of Lancashire Constabulary, Andy Rhodes. Well, a lot has happened since then. Andy Rhodes is now the Chief Constable and continues to carry forward the wellbeing programme as the national lead for England and Wales. It's only fitting, therefore, in what is the last podcast of 2017, we revisit the wellbeing programme. Andy Rhodes is in a philosophical mood as we look back on the last 12 months and discuss the challenges ahead. So join us now in the boardroom of the Lancashire Fire and Rescue Headquarters. It's been a year now since our last interview. You said to me then that as a senior police leader confided in you that since his promotion to Chief Constable, he hadn't had a bad idea and nobody was telling him. Since your promotion to Chief, have you had any bad ideas and has anybody told you?
Well, I have loads of bad ideas every day, Dave, to us. They're not such bad ideas, they're just because I tend to talk as I think, and what I've learnt is over the years that when you're talking about ideas, that sometimes people think you've formed an opinion and want it to happen, i.e. it's a decision. So I've learned to surround myself with people who understand that's how I think out loud and are quite happy to challenge my thinking around it. The main difference I've had, I would say, since becoming chief is the deputy chief constable I've got is somebody who's not from Lancashire. Uh-huh. She thinks very similar to me, but she is very keen and confident to challenge certain ways of thinking that you've got. Because mm-hmm. I've worked here all my service, and even I, you know, sometimes don't realise that I'm locked into a certain way of thinking about things. And that has been probably one of the things I've learnt, that I want to surround myself, and I'm doing this more and more, with people who aren't from the same walk of life as me, maybe not even from the same organisation as me, and they look at things very differently, and sometimes that's a real benefit. Yeah. So it's not always about saying you've not had any bad ideas. There's no way the person I work with now and on my team, the people I work with on my team, would agree to doing something just because I think it's a good idea. They wouldn't, because that's just not how it's happened.
So I suppose quite healthy. It's having that fresh set of eyes, I guess.
It is, fresh set of eyes. I'm going, why do you do things like that? I said, I don't know, I've always done it like that. You know, some of that's behavioural stuff that's, yeah, you know, unhelpful, yeah, you know, so.
Of course, what you might have been suggesting to them was a culture within the police where folk were afraid to speak, honestly. That culture is changing, and we'll talk more about that in a moment. Recently, there's been a surge of peer-to-peer support within Lancashire Police. How do we continue to make that work, especially across the various ranks where police leaders themselves feel the need to offload?
Where I think learning from the last sort of 4 or 5 years on wellbeing, one of the key things I've learned is, and it comes a bit of a shock to you when you think that you are the place where people will go to if they need support, is that you are not. What we know from all the stuff that's been done, the Police Dependence Trust research and everything, is that people, particularly around psychological issues such as stress and anxiety, will go where they want to go. And so what we know is that they will go to peers, they will go to family and friends, they will go online, they'll go to social media networks. And we've just got to be comfortable with that and have it in a model of safe care. So what we've done is we've done a review of occupational health. We realise that this isn't all occupational health business. It's about the organisation being more able to speak openly about these issues, but in a safe way. So Dr. Tony Parnell, who has recently started, is an expert in trauma psychological education. He's leading all this work for us. He's now on the books. And his job is to create that safe model of care for our people, running right the way to the crisis end, from the crisis end through to the conversation in the corridor. So the peers that have come have emerged in a very sort of social network way. Nobody in the organisation said, we want wellbeing buddies. People have just said, we want to do it. And that ultimately, to me, is the goal around prevention with wellbeing. When you actually get people in the workplace saying, I think this is important, what I want to help, and I want to play a part in that, it's my job to make sure they're equipped, supported, given the information they need to be able to do that job really safely.
Yes. Because it's almost like it's self-sustaining, isn't it?
That's it.
Because that changes culture. Because there's 130 people have volunteered to be wellbeing buddies in literally a week. Now, they haven't... If I'd have put an advert out, the chief constable wants to become a wellbeing buddy, I wouldn't have had 130 people. And straight away, they become an organisational asset. So to the people who are looking for support, they're thinking, are you part of the organisation or are you part of my workplace, my network? Are you like me? And so I think this is really interesting stuff about how people feel confident to talk openly, which is the key to resolving trauma exposure as and when it happens, not waiting for it to hit crisis. Yeah. The more we can get going in the workplace, you'll start to see people changing their attitudes and become more confident.
I mean, I get a sense in people in leadership roles, and that's from, you know, sergeants and above, quite a young force in that respect. There's a lot of new people coming through, and I suppose that brings into generation gaps, and that's a whole different topic we could talk about. But I do worry about support for those lower and middle line leaders that perhaps feel between a rock and a hard place, perhaps still due to culture and deference and all the stigmas attached to that.
Well, this came up at the trauma conference, because I was really glad that sergeant said, hold on a minute, all the solutions to these problems we're putting up look like my line manager. And I've got a team with 18 people, I need days off. And it was all about your line manager. I said, right, let's be really clear on this. The role mainly of a line manager in this, and everybody you're talking about as their own line manager, is primarily to be approachable. Not to be a counsellor and a psychotherapist. And then to be well informed about what's on offer.
Yes.
So if you come to me in the corridor and you want to talk to me, you need to be able to feel as though I can just tell him what's happening. So it might be something in your personal life, might be something in your work life. Mm. And that you're approachable. Not that you're somebody you don't speak to. Yes. That is not the same as thinking that every sergeant's going to spend hours and hours with people trying to unravel whatever their problems are. We need in our system lots of resources that people can choose from. Mm. But the primary thing is, I've got somebody I work with close on a daily basis who's going to just say to me, I've noticed, Dave, that you've been a little bit more irritable today when we've been in. Are you all right? Mm. What's on your mind? Right, what's on my mind is I've got a child that's really ill and I found out today and it's on my mind and it's really quite stressful. Right, this is what the organisation's got for you.
Yeah.
I suppose it's about having open doors.
Open doors, yeah. And I speak to a lot of senior people, so I've got an open door policy. And I say, well, nobody comes in it. Are you with me? If you're not approachable, there's no point leaving your door open.
Yes.
It's a personality issue, not a door issue.
Yeah.
Now, part of creating that culture, I guess, was a small part of the bigger picture. As a national lead on wellbeing, you mentioned last year you had several projects you wanted to bring forward. Remind us what they were and how you're doing.
Well, nationally, Oscar Kilo is the big one that we've done with Public Health England. In the last 12 months, we've got every force in the country now signed up to go through the Blue Light Wellbeing Framework, which is a police law enforcement specific, it could apply to other emergency services as well, organisational self-assessment to be world-class at wellbeing. It's not an off-the-shelf that would work at a B&Q or another employer. Mm. It is tuned in with the evidence base to the College of Policing about what sort of issues our staff face. It's because it's a unique environment. Mm. Every force in the country are going through that now. Started in May last year. There are other organisations signed up to it, including the NCA, CNC, lots of other people want to get on board with it, including the fire service nationally. So that's the big platform, and I've now got a contribution off every police force in the country, very small, that keeps the Oscar Kilo back office running. Mm. That's the employer offer. What we're then branching out to, looking forward, is that I've just been given and applied for significant funding from the Police Transformation Fund, National Welfare Fund, to do a capability uplift to deal with the issues that are coming out of that framework. Now, what that looks like is that will be a whole programme of work for 2.5 years, where we're actually going into every force in the country and supporting them to address and build the capabilities around some of the key things coming out of the framework, which will be first line manager, it'll be safe models, peer support, trauma interventions. We've got a piece of research being done on that. So we are going to move into a different level now because we've got some resource to make some serious changes. And my job as national lead is to respond to that blue light framework. Mm. What's it telling us? Where are our gaps? And really start giving the support out there to forces who are keen to start developing this work now. Mm. But tangible stuff on the ground that the front line will see. Are you with me? Because you've got to start at the beginning with this. Do employers understand what needs to be done? Do they know where they are on the journey? And what are the resources that we can give them to help them improve? That's my job.
Yeah. And I'm curious, as you have the overview of the police service as a whole in the UK, whether there are specific wellbeing issues specific to certain forces, perhaps, or areas?
Well, the really difficult thing about wellbeing is that it can mean many things to many people. But actually, to be come to work and be able to flourish and thrive and be happy requires a range of things to be done in that organisation. And one of them is that the workplace you work in is a compassionate workplace for you. And all the evidence says that if you can do that, then our staff can go and be compassionate with the public. It's two sides of the same coin.
Yes.
Now, where you've got organisations where they're struggling to create that environment, you will get more severe problems. But you also need to look at the real basic stuff about this, around workloads, about risk aversion, about trust, about leadership behaviours. Mm. All these sort of things play in. We all want to work in an environment where we think the boss, quite frankly, gives a crap about us. Mm. That is a biggie. Mm. And people need to feel as though they're valued. And so there's a lot of myths around wellbeing where people think it's all about tofu bars at headquarters and yoga sessions.
Yeah.
And that the stress that our staff put themselves into is something that is the main reason they've got a wellbeing issue. It's not. They willingly put themselves in that position. Mm. What drives them nuts is unfair promotion processes, IT that doesn't work, a boss who's not very nice, yeah, logistics, yeah, workload, doing work that's pointless because the bureaucracy around it's just all about risk aversion. Do you see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So when you really get into wellbeing, you realise that it's about the meaning and purpose of work and whether enabling our great people to achieve that and what's getting in the way.
And I think it was something you alluded to last week, where people feel they're not getting that, then it leads to resentment, which is a huge barrier to...
Of course it is, you see. So what I say to people is understand the issue. Ask your people what's affecting the wellbeing.
Mm.
Don't just go herring off thinking you know the answers, because I don't. So I spoke to some sergeants over at Burnley the other day, Sneater, I've seen every sergeant, inspector, team leader in the force, personally, in small groups. And I said, post-incident management. I said, I think we've got it nailed down for firearms. The serious stuff was the phrase I used.
Mm.
And he looked at me and said, that's interesting. You think that's the serious stuff.
Mm.
That's not what I think's the serious stuff. And it's not what the front line generally think is.
Mm.
It's a fatal after a pursuit or a serious injury. It's a death in custody or a death after a concern for welfare call. What's your post-incident management support welfare like for that?
Yes.
Good question.
Yes.
You see what I mean? If you're not asking people, you assume what's bothering you is what's bothering them.
Well, that very nicely brings us on to my next question. So, clearly the police have made considerable progress across the county with regards to wellbeing and its attitudes towards its own staff. Indeed, not that long ago, officers sharing on social media the sorts of frustrations they're feeling at the moment would have been sacked. So now that the wellbeing is firmly going down the road, do you feel that you have a finite amount of time to produce tangible results for those frontline officers before they lose patience and consign wellbeing to the bin?
This in Lancashire?
Yes.
Yeah, right, okay. Well, I what I've learnt is, Dave, that people judge you by what they see, not your intentions. So you can have all the great intentions in the world. If there's tangibly things aren't changing,
yes,
then quite rightly they'll say, well, I hear what you're saying, but it's not happening here. Mm. And we've had some wake-up calls with that recently. So we are, everything that we are doing has got, big decisions-wise in this force, has got an aspect of it that is influenced by what our staff are saying affects their well-being. That's how big a deal it is. Mm. So we are currently completely redesigning Force Control Room and investing a lot more money in it. Now, there is a big purpose of that, is to pick the calls up better, deal with the demand better. But actually, you look at the turnover rates and the stress levels in there, it's about people coming to work and feeling valued and doing a job that's worthwhile. Mm. Because, in a sense, I want that, because that's what I feel passionately about, that people should be able to come to work and flourish.
Yes.
But also, if I'm looking at it in a business sense, I don't want them to go sick. Mm. I don't want them to leave when I've trained them. Because yes, the turnover rates in contact centres are high. Mm. You know, 3 times the average in the rest of the workforce. In some forces, they're 5 times the average. Mm. So that's really expensive and bad for business as well, which is the sharp end of wellbeing.
Yes.
Get it right, things go well. So what people are saying to us is, Andy, I get all that, yeah, but I've got a detective with a workload of 50. What are you doing about that?
Yes.
Yeah? That's why we're doing all the resourcing uplift and making some tough decisions about what's a priority and what isn't.
Yes.
Now, I think, what I'm hearing is, people are seeing for the first time their interpretation of whether we care about their well-being is workload, IT and resources.
Mm.
Are you with me? Mm. It's not actually, can't change the world operationally out there. That's the job.
Yes.
But how we deal with it is a different matter. I'm confident that their expectations will continue to be met as long as we listen to them and we respond in terms of how we're doing our job in terms of changing the organisation.
Yes.
I suppose it does come down to personal resilience in a bit, because these things aren't going to happen overnight. So it is a case of just holding our nerve perhaps a little bit, because change will come, but perhaps not as quick as perhaps some people would like it to.
Yeah, and what I thought was interesting at a trauma event was one of the big things people picked up on from Dr. Noreen Tarani was the cognitive empathy.
Mm.
So what am I doing about how I deal with this? Am I developing my own levels of self-awareness about what affects my stress and anxiety, and then making some choices myself? Are you with me?
Yeah.
Because that's sustainable. Because, you know, there's a lot of pressure on the police service, and I can't change some of that pressure.
No.
But there's a great saying by one of the great modern philosophers, where he said, the greatest discovery of his generation was that people can change the way their attitudes of mind by the way they think. Are you with me? They can change their lives by changing their attitude. It's how you reframe it.
Yes.
Are you with me? And I thought that trauma conference was interesting.
Yes.
Because actually we need to reframe it, that we do an amazing job for the public and we expose ourselves to trauma because that's the job.
Yes.
Don't try and deny that. Right, how do we deal with it? At a personal level and organisational level, so that it becomes something positive we do for the public. Because we're public servants at the end of the day. And when they call us, that's what they expect us to do.
Yeah.
Well, I've done several podcasts this week, and the one overriding theme that's come out of them is how we think about things.
Yeah.
And our attitude to say how you think to a situation would be different to I. And it's how we deal with that.
That's right. And I think that's, to me, the one message I get across to people is there's a huge amount. I mean, it's going to be a permanent journey we're on to improve the workplace around wellbeing,
mm,
because it's so broad and complex that it affects things. The big, big one for individuals when I speak to them is, do you spot the signs in yourself? Have you got the support where you need it to go to? Can you catch things early? And can you process it? And then, are you with me? Can you look for the support you've got? Generally, if you're doing that really well, the worst thing that can happen is worse work can make it worse.
Yes.
Are you with me? So I spot my stress in myself very quickly. And I know that I have to make some choices about how I deal with it.
Mm.
Otherwise, things will escalate.
It's been less emotive about, more the head and less of the heart.
Well, it's about actually being really tough on yourself sometimes and saying, look, there's still a certain amount of this I can cope with at the moment. I need a break. Mm. And, you know, I need to go somewhere where I'm going to get some energy back.
Yes. Finally, as technology becomes more a part of everyday life, and modern-day policing is no exception, how do we address the generation gap between the older and younger officers, both philosophically and technologically? And were we emotionally unprepared for the massive changes that it's brought?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I mean, I'm in that generation where I'm clinging on. So, you know, when I was at school, we didn't have desktop computers, computer studies and all that sort of stuff, you know. And so for me, you know, technology has been something that I have had to learn as I've gone along. And I understand that the type of world that we're operating in now with the frontline police officer or, you know, behind the scenes in policing, technology is everything. Mm. And so, you know, I often travel and I'm on the tube and I see some, you know, young person on the laptop on the knee and they touch typing and they do it, you know what I mean? And I just think, oh, right, it's amazing. Their digital skills compared to mine. Yes. I think what we've underestimated completely in policing is that the how stressful it is to not feel as though you're coming to terms with new technology when it's such a key part of you trying to achieve what you want at work. You know what I mean? And so I understand it because I find technology quite stressful. And it, like anything that's stressful, it's fight or flight. Yes. You'll either kick the computer or you'll avoid it. Mm. And I think what we find with our staff is they get very angry. That's the fight thing, and yes, criticise the kit and all that sort of stuff, sometimes legitimately, or they avoid it and they don't use it. Mm. Are you with me? And yes, it's getting to the point, isn't it, in policing where you cannot avoid it.
Yes.
It's there, isn't it?
And I suppose it, for some, certainly myself, almost like a bereavement, this culture shock of having to adapt to all these new technologies.
Yeah, I remember when it came in, Dave. You know, I was a sergeant at Preston and I had ARVs, dogs and football planning and stuff like that. And it came in, all of a sudden I found the dog handlers coming in and there was a desktop and they did a G43 for a new dog lead on a nice, really printed piece of paper. Mm. When actually they could have done it in the van and written it.
Yes.
Are you with me? So, you know, we got into the desktops and the desktops pulled people back in the neck.
Yes.
Now we've got mobile technology. What we've learned, and this is really interesting, the Samsung rollout, we will say in Lancashire Stabbury, is the most successful piece of organisational change we've delivered. And when you ask yourself why, it's because the people went out into the workplace and said to the staff who use it, what do you want it to do?
Yes.
How do you want it to work? Mm. And we had the ability with that piece of kit, which we haven't got with everything, to adapt it to the needs of the user.
Yes.
And you will not find very many people in the front line who don't like the Samsungs. Mm. I even went to the CID office where you were the other day, and some of the detectives said, can we have a Samsung?
Yes.
Now, how often does that happen? That people actually ask you for some technology?
Yes.
So it can be done, but it's got to be done in the right way. You can't just force technology on people and expect them to use it, particularly people who are not comfortable with it.
And I suppose it brings us to that fine line of where technology makes the job easier but takes us away from our colleagues.
We were talking today, electronic case file. It's not made the job any easier. I can't see any benefit to me other than a load of work. Are you with me? Now, I can see across the criminal justice system that somebody somewhere thinks it's a great idea and it's a blindingly obvious thing to do to have an electronic case file, because in this day and age, that's what we should have. Are you with me? But for the police service, the pain's all at the front end.
Yes.
And so we shouldn't be marketing this as something that's brilliant and going to improve your life. We should be saying to our staff, sorry, folks, it's going to be harder than what you used to do before.
Yes.
But we haven't. We've tried to market it as like, you know, something great for you. Mm. And people look very personally at what's in it for me, this. Why, you know, electronic case file is just nothing but a pain in the neck for most frontline people.
Yeah. As we should. Sometimes innovation is brought in to make somebody else's life easier, not necessarily your own.
I saw a thing the other day, it said, why should I innovate for you? You've really got to find things that matter to people for them want to innovate, because innovation is quite hard. Mm. And it's difficult, isn't it? And, you know, it requires a lot of extra effort. So really the trick to pull off is to find out what hooks your staff into innovation.
Yes.
So most police officers and police staff are really keen on protecting people. You know, they get that, you know, I joined the job actually to make a bit of a difference. Yes. And protect people. So does this technology help me to do that, or does it make it harder?
Mm.
Now, if you look at the crime and intel stuff with Connect, it'll make it easier.
Mm.
Because you'll have one button to press that'll tell you everything about Dave.
Mm.
Whereas currently you have to check multiple systems.
Yes.
So to be able to keep people safe, it's a piece of kit that enables you to do it. So we need to say to people, that's the point of it. It's the why question of this technology.
Yes.
The why question isn't it saves money, it's more efficient and all that. The why question is, it saves kids' lives. It saves vulnerable people's lives, this technology. So we really want to get you bought into it, because that's what it's supposed to be able to do.
Okay, I have three questions on this piece of card, 1, 2, and 3, and I'm going to ask you to pick one of them, and I will read the question out to you and answer it to the best of your ability. So 1, 2, or 3?
3.
Was there a moment in your life when you have learnt more about yourself than at any other time?
Oh, that is a very, very tough question to spring on somebody, Dave.
Sorry.
And you'll get... You know, I mean, I have talked about this. I mean, I had a fantastic career in the police, but at a certain point in my career, I got my work and my personal life completely out of balance.
Mm.
And unfortunately, that went pop. But I was on a roll. You know, everything was going right.
Yes.
But my personal life was going wrong. And when it went pop, I took a long, hard look at myself. Very difficult to do.
Mm.
Ideally, you would have done it without facing a crisis in your life. But many people only do this when they're forced to do it because of some sort of crisis, don't they? So I took a long, hard look at myself, actually, and took responsibility for it eventually. And unfortunately, a lot of damage had been done around my personal life before I actually had that long, hard look at myself. And I always say, you know, and I'd say this to my ex-wife, if I was her, I'd have left me a long time before she did.
Yes.
But I don't blame her for it, because some of the ways that work was everything.
Yes.
I don't blame work, it's my own fault, but police work, if you allow it to, will dominate your life. And it's not easy to be married to somebody who's in policing, or to be a partner of somebody who's in policing, or be a kid of somebody who's in policing. It is the type of profession that will, you can just let it take over, because it's, you know, you're passionate about it and stuff. So that was my responsibility, not the jobs. And I learnt everything. Yes. About myself there. And you've got to do some hard work on yourself.
Mm.
It is tough work to pick yourself up from that and actually do the personal development work.
It's interesting, because I was speaking with Jackie Morton last weekend, as I'm sure you know, as an ex DCI in the Met, flying squad. Very hard drinker, and I asked her, did she feel annoyed that she had to go through all that to find her true self? And she said she wouldn't have swapped it for a thing, because it's the person that she is.
The person she is, yeah. And I think there's a lot talked about this, Dave, actually, in leadership circles, that really a form of vulnerability is part and parcel of being a really good leader, because you can have empathy for other people. And there is quite a bit of work being done on, actually, that most people who make the best leaders have had some form of big moment in their life.
Yes.
That's made them the person they are, you know. And some of that is about realizing that you are only human.
Yes.
And therefore the people who you work with and who you go on to lead are just human as well.
Yes.
And it gives you that empathy.
Yes.
For people. But, you know, I'm not naturally built like that.
Yes.
So unfortunately I had to have some form of a train crash.
Yes.
To, like Jackie probably did, to have that sort of moment where you think, right, something's got to change here.
Yeah.
But you know, it's not always great in life if things look like they're going fantastic for you all the time.
Yes.
You know what I mean? You start thinking that, you know, you've got some sort of, you're on a roll.
Yeah. But the other interesting thing that she said was that ultimately, the answer was always within her. Always, yeah. It was always there.
Yeah. You see, the thing is with it, once you start doing personal development properly, and I use that because a lot of people don't do it properly. They do it in quite a superficial way. Once you start doing it properly, you go all the way back to childhood, and you start realizing what's made you the person you are, the goods and the bads, and you start unpicking it a little bit, and you learn through your personal development how to manage some of it, because you never really change the person you are, but you learn how to manage it, and you know, take the positives from it.
Well, Andy Rhodes, thank you very much again.
Okay, Dave, nice to meet you. A year on.
A year on.
Doesn't seem that long since.
Time flies.
Yeah, see you again another year.
Hope so.